Jody called out. I want the cubs. I want the cubs. Millwheel said, Let's knock her out and leave the dogs have a go round. Penny said, We'll have four tore up dogs if you do. Buck said, You mighty right. We best drop her and be done with it. He shot. The dogs were on her the instant she hit the ground. If there was a spark of life, it was at once snuffed out. Buck climbed up the low tree and shook the limb. Jody called again, I want the cubs. He planned, when they dropped, to run to them and pick them up. He was sure they would be gentle. They fell finally under Buck's vigorous shaking. Jody darted in, but the dogs were ahead of him. The cubs were dead, and shaken and tossed before he could approach them. Yet in their dying, he saw that they slashed at the dogs and bit and clawed. He would have had ragged flesh, he realized, to show for his seizing of them. Yet he wished they were still alive. Penny said, Sorry, boy, but you'd not have had nothing you'd have cared to keep. Them scapers learns meanness early. Jody eyed the small, fierce teeth. Can I have the hides for another knapsack? Why, sure. Here, Buck, help me get 'em away from the dogs before they're tore up. Jody took the limp bodies and cradled them. I hate things dying, he said. The men were silent. Penny said slowly, Nothing's spared, son, if that be airy comfort to you.
Tain't.
Well, hits a stone wall nobody's yet clumb over. You can kick it and crack your head agin it and holler, but nobody'll listen and nobody'll answer. Buck said, Well, when it come my time, I sure aim to get my money's worth hollering. They called the dogs away from the dead panther. She measured 9 feet from tip of nose to end of long curled tail. She was too lean, however, to dress out for her oil. Penny said, I got to either catch me a fat panther or quit having rheumatism. The hide, too, was in poor condition. They cut away the heart and liver to roast for the dogs. Penny said, No use nussing them cubs no longer, Jody. Give 'em here and go fetch wood. I'll skin 'em out for you. He went away. The evening was clear and rosy. The sun was drawing water. Shadowy fingers reached through the luminous sky to the sodden earth. The wet leaves of the scrub oaks, the thin needles of the pines, glittered, and he forgot his distress. There was much to be done to make camp. All wood was wet, but prowling about, he found a fallen pine whose core was rich with resin. He called, and Buck and Millwheel came and dragged it bodily to the campsite. It would make a burning base to dry out the other wood. They chopped it in half and laid the two long pieces side by side. Jody struggled with flint and steel from the tinder horn until Penny took it away from him and kindled a fire between the logs with fat wood splinters. He piled on small brush that caught fire quickly. Larger limbs and logs were added. They smoked and smoldered, but ended by bursting into flame. Now there was a glowing bed on which the wettest logs might dry and then burn slowly. Jody dragged in all available wood that was not too heavy to handle alone. He had a high pile ready for the night's long burning. Buck and Millwheel dragged in logs as big as themselves. Penny cut out the back straps from the fattest buck and sliced them for frying for supper. Millwheel appeared from a prowl with palmetto fronds to be used as plates for laying out the food and other camp means of tidiness. He had as well the hearts of 2 palms. He pulled away layer after layer of the white cores and came at last to the hearts, crisp and sweet. He said, Now I want that frying pan, Mr. Penny, please, for my swamp cabbage. Then I'll leave you fry that back strap when I'm done with the pan. He sliced the palm hearts thinly. Where's the grease, Penny?
In a bottle in the crocus sack.
Jody ambled about watching the others. His job was to feed the fire with twigs to keep the flame from dying too low. The logs blazed brightly. There were already embers suitable for roasting. Buck whittled forked sticks on which each could roast his meat.
Millwield dipped water from a nearby pond for his pan of swamp cabbage, covered it with a section of palm frond, and set it over the coals to cook. Penny said, "Now I forgot the coffee." Buck said, "Well, with old Doc Wilson's whiskey, I'll not miss it." He brought out the bottle and passed it. Penny was ready for the frying pan for his venison, but the swamp cabbage was not done. He improvised spits on which he hung the wildcat carcasses. He sliced the wildcat and panther hearts and livers and stuck them on sticks and propped them over the coals to roast. The smell was enticing. Jody sniffed the air and sniffed again and patted his flat stomach. Penny sliced the deer livers and placed them more carefully on Buck's folded sticks and gave each man his own roasting fork to hold to cook his meat to his own taste. The flames licked around the dog meat, and the odor brought in the dogs. They came close and lay flat and slapped their tails back and forth and whined. Raw cat meat was not too much to their fancy. They had gnawed a bit on it by way of proving their victory. The roasted flesh was another thing. They licked their chops. Jody said, "I'll bet that's good."
"Well, try it." Penny withdrew a portion from the fire and held it out to him. "Look out, it's hotter than stewed apples."
He hesitated over the strangeness, then touched his finger to the hot savory meat and put his finger in his mouth. He said, "'Tis good." The men laughed, but he ate two slices. Penny said,
"Now, some folks would say he'd make you fearless eating wildcat liver. We'll just see."
Buck said,
"Dogged if it don't smell fine. Give him out here."
He sampled it and agreed that it was as good as any other liver. Millwheel ate a portion then, but Penny refused.
"If I was to get any braver," he said, "I'd be romping on you foresters and getting hell beat out of me again."
They passed the bottle once more. The fire blazed. The meat dripped its juices into the flames. The fragrance eddied up with the smoke. The sun set behind the scrub oaks, and Millwheel's swamp cabbage was done. Penny emptied it on a clean palm frond and put it over a smoldering log to keep warm. He wiped out the frying pan with a handful of moss and set it back over the coals to heat. He sliced bacon into it. When the bacon was brown and the fat sizzling hot, he fried the thin slices of backstrap crisp and tender. Buck cut scoops from the palm stems and everyone dipped, share and share alike, into the swamp cabbage. Penny made hush puppies of meal and salt and water and fried them in the fat the venison had cooked in. Buck said,
"Now if I knowed they'd feed you this good in heaven, I'd not holler when I die."
Millwheel said,
"Rations taste a heap better in the woods. I'd rather eat cold bread in the woods than hot pudding in the house." "Now, you know," Penny said, "the same dog bit me."
The cat meat was done. They cooled it a little and threw it to the dogs. The dogs bolted it greedily, then went to the pond to drink. They prowled about for a time, excited by the varying scents, then returned to lie by the blazing campfire in the increasing chill of the evening. Buck and Millwheel and Jody had stuffed. They dropped flat on their backs and stared up into the sky. Penny said,
"Flood or no flood, this is fine. I want you fellers to promise me one thing. When I'm an old man, set me on a stump and leave me to listen to the hunt. Don't go off and leave me in the bay."
Stars twinkled, the first in 9 days. Penny stirred at last to clean up the debris. He tossed the dogs the leftover cornmeal patties. He put the corn cob stopper back in the bottle of fat. He held it up to the firelight. He shook it. He said,
"I'll be blasted. We've et my rubbin' medicine."
He pawed in the crocus sack and brought out the other bottle and opened it. It held, unmistakably, the lard oil.
"Millwheel, you jaybird, you opened the panther oil for the swamp cabbage."
There was silence. Jody felt his stomach turn over. Millwheel said,
"How'd I know 'twas panther oil?"
Buck swore under his breath. Then he burst into a thunderous laughter.
"I ain't going to let my imagination quarrel with what goes in my belly," he said. "I never ate better swamp cabbage."
"Nor me," Penny said. "But when my bones gets to aching, I wish 'twas back where it come from."
Buck said, "Anyways, we know what to use for grease when we get kitched in the woods." Jody's stomach quieted. After two slices of wildcat liver, it would be poor business to be squeamish. But the panther oil did seem different, after having seen Penny rub it on his knees on winter evenings. Millwheel said,
"Well, I'll cut everybody bowels for beds, long as I'm the ones in disgrace."
Penny said, "I'll come with you. If I was to go to sleep and raise up and see you in the bushes, I'd figure 'twas a bear, sure."
"I'll swear, I don't see how some of you fellers growed so big."
Millwheel said,
"Why, hell, we was raised on panther oil."
Everyone went in high humor to cut his own bed. Jody broke small pine boughs with the needles on them and gathered moss for a mattress. They laid the pallets close to the fire. The foresters lay down on their boughs with a crashing sound. Penny said,
"Now I'll bet old Slewfoot don't make that much fuss when he lays down."
Buck said,
"And I'll bet you can hear a June bird going to bed a heap further than one of you Baxters."
Millwheel said, "I wished I had me a sack of corn shucks now for a mattress." Penny said,
"The best bed I ever had was one made of the fluff from cattail rushes. Hit were like lying on a cloud."
Bud had taken the time to gather enough cattails. Buck said,
"The best bed in all the world is a feather bed."
Penny said, "Everyone ever tell you fellers about the time your daddy raised pure hell with a feather bed?"
"Tell it."
"Hit were before you were born. Maybe 2-3 of you was back in the house, some mares and cradles. I were just a little old young'un myself. I come over to your island with my own daddy. Reckon maybe he come to try to give your pa salvation.
When he was young, your pa was wilder than you all. He could tip a jug of corn liquor back and drink it down like water, and he done so in them days right frequent. Well, we rode up to your door, and here was broke dishes and rations all strode down the walk, chairs pitched over the gate, and all over the yard, and all along the fence row, was feathers. Looked as if chicken heaven had done blowed up. Laying on the stoop was the ticking of the feather bed where it'd been split open with a knife. Your daddy come to the gate. Now, I won't say he was drunk, but he sure had done been drunk. He tore up everything had taken his eye, and the last thing he noticed was the feather bed. Now, he wasn't mad nor quarreling. He was just having him a big time, cracking things open. He'd got all over it and was peaceful and happy as could be. Now, what your ma was doing and saying whilst he was at it, you'd know better than me. But right now, she was still and cold as ice. She was sitting rocking with her hands folded and her mouth like a steel trap. My daddy had sense, if he was a preacher, and I reckon he figured another time it'd be best for whatever 'twas he'd come to say. So he just passed the time of day and set out to ride on again. Well, your ma come to and remembered her manners and called out to him. "Stay eat with us, Mr. Baxter," she said. "I got nothing left to offer you but corn pone and honey. If I can find a whole plate for you to eat on." Your pa turned and looked at her, surprised. "Honey," he said.
"Honey?
Is there any honey in the honey jug?"
The foresters shouted and slapped each other. Buck said,
"Wait till I walk in and ask Ma, 'Honey, is there any honey in the honey jug?' Oh, wait."
Jody laughed to himself long after the foresters were quiet. His father made a story so real. He could see the feathers still, blown against the split rail fence. The dogs, roused by the laughter, stirred and changed their positions. They had edged close for the warmth of the humans and of the fire. Old Julia lay at his father's feet. He wished Flag were with him, to snuggle close with his smooth, warm coat. Buck rose and pulled another log on the fire. The men began to talk of the probable movements of the scrub and swamp animals. The wolves were evidently moving in another direction from the rest of the animals. They disliked wet sections even more than the big cats and were no doubt in the heart of the high scrub. Bear had not been as plentiful as expected. Buck said,
"You know where the bears be?"
"South in the scrub around Sellers Bear Hole and Squaw Pond Bear Hole." Millwheel said,
"Tolly's hammock, I'll bet you, toward the river."
Penny said, "They'll not be south. The wind and rain the last days all come from the southeast. They'd put it behind them, not go into it." Jody put his arms under his head and looked up into the sky. It was as thick with stars as a pool of silver minnows. Between the two tall pines over him, the sky was milky, as though Trixie had kicked a great bucket of milk foaming across the heavens. The pines swayed back and forth in a light, cool breeze. Their needles were washed with the silver of the starlight. Smoke from the campfire eddied up and joined the stars. He watched it drift through the pine tops. His eyelids fluttered. He didn't want to go to sleep. He wanted to listen. The hunting talk of men was the finest talk in the world. Chills went along his spine to hear it. The smoke against the stars was a veil drawn back and forth across his eyes. He closed them. For a moment, the talk of the men was a deep droning against the snapping of the wet wood. Then it faded into the sound of the breeze in the pines and was no longer sound, but the voiceless murmur of a dream. He was awakened in the night by his father, sitting bolt upright. Buck and Millwheel were snoring heavily. The fire had died low. The wet wood was sizzling slowly. He sat up beside Penny. Penny whispered,
"Listen."
Far in the night, an owl hooted and a panther screamed. There was a closer sound. It sounded like the air dying from a bellows. It seemed almost at their feet. Jody's flesh crept. It might be Fodderwing's Spaniard. Were hants susceptible like mortals, he wondered, to flood and rain? Did they yearn to warm their thin, transparent hands at a hunter's campfire? Penny eased himself to his feet and fumbled for a pine knot for a torch. He lit it at the fire and started forward cautiously. The sighing sound had ceased. Jody followed close behind him. There was a rustling. Penny swung the torch. A pair of eyes, red as a bull bat's, caught the light. He shifted the light. He laughed. The visitor was an alligator from the pond. He said,
"He smelt the fresh meat. Now wouldn't I love to drop him on top of them foresters?"
Jody said, "'Twas it him making that sighing?"
"It were him breathing and blowing and raising himself up and down."
"Let's torment Buck and Millwheel with him."
Penny hesitated.
"He's a mite big for funnin'. He'll go 6 feet. If he was to take a chunk out in one of them, he'd be a sorry joke."
"Will we kill him?"
"Nah, use. We'll be getting meat for the dogs and to spare. Gators is harmless things."
"You going to leave him blow around all night?"
"No, for he'd quit blowing and go to hunting that meat he smells."
Penny made a rush at the alligator. It lifted its body on its short legs and turned back toward the pond. Penny ran after it, stopping to pick up sand or whatever came under his hand to throw after it. It ran with amazing speed. Penny followed and Jody behind him until a splash sounded at some distance.
"There, he's back with his kinfolks. Now do he be polite enough to stay there, we'll not bother him."
They turned back to the campfire. It glowed comfortingly in the darkness. The midnight was still. The stars were so bright that when they looked away from the fire, they could see the water shining in the ponds. The air was cool. Jody wished that he could camp always like this, with his father. All that he lacked was Flag beside him. Penny moved the torch across the foresters. Buck threw his arm across his face, but slept on. Millwheel was flat on his back, his black beard lifted and fell with his heavy breathing.
"He blows near about as deep as a gator," Penny said.
They piled more wood on the fire and returned to their pallets. They didn't seem as comfortable as when they had first lain down on them. They shook up the moss and tried to flatten the pine boughs. Jody made a nest for himself in the middle and curled up kitten-wise. He lay a few luxurious moments, watching the fresh blaze, then fell into a sleep as deep as the first. The dogs were the first to awaken at daybreak. A fox had crossed under their noses, leaving its rank taint fresh on the air. Penny jumped up and caught them and tied them.
"We got bigger business today than fox," he told them.
From where he lay, Jody could look straight across into the sunrise. It was strange to see it on a level with his face. At home, the thick scrub growth beyond the cleared fields obscured it. Now, there was only a morning fog between. The sun didn't seem to rise, but to sweep forward through a gray curtain. The curtain began to part its folds for the passing. The light was the thin, pale gold of his mother's wedding ring. It grew brighter and brighter until he found himself blinking into the very face of the sun. The light September fog clung tenaciously a little while to the tops of the trees, as though resisting the tearing and destructive fingers of the sun. Then it too was gone, and the whole east was the color of ripe guavas. Penny called,
"I need somebody to help find the panther oil so I can cook breakfast."
Buck and Millwheel sat up. They were stiff from their heavy sleep. Penny said,
"The gators and the foxes has been running right across to you fellers."
He told of the night's encounter. Buck said,
"You sure 'twasn't one of them swamp skeeters you seed after Doc Wilson's liquor?"
"A foot less, and I'd say maybe, but not scarcely 6 feet." "Oh, yes. Why, I went to sleep on a camp like this once, and I dreamed I heard a skeeter buzzing, and when I waked up, here was me and my bed both hanging up on a snag in a cypress swamp."
Penny called Jody to wash his face and hands at the pond's edge. When they reached the water, the stench turned them back. Penny said comfortably,
"Well, our dirt is nothing but wood smoke. Even your ma wouldn't make you wash in that kind of water."
Breakfast was the same as supper, except that there was no more swamp cabbage with panther oil. Again, the foresters substituted a draught of whiskey for the missing coffee. Penny refused it. The pond water was not fit to drink, and Jody was thirsty. In a world so full of water, it had occurred to no one to carry it. Penny said,
"You watch for a holler log as well off the ground, and has rainwater in it. Rainwater is all as fitting."
The fried and roasted venison and the hush puppies didn't taste as good as the night before. Penny cleaned up after breakfast. Grazing for the horses had been poor because the grasses were beaten flat. Jody gathered armfuls of moss for them, and they ate it with relish. Breaking camp, mounting, turning the heads of the horses south was the beginning of a fresh journey. Jody looked over his shoulder. The campsite was desolate. The charred logs, the gray ashes, were forlorn. The magic had died out with the flames of the campfire. The morning had been cool, but the climbing sun began to heat the day. The earth steamed. The stench of the polluted waters was often overpowering. Penny in the lead called back,
"I wonder, can creatures' bellies stand this rotten water?"
Buck and Millwheel shook their heads. The flood was unprecedented in the scrub. No man could tell what would come of it. The cavalcade continued steadily south. Penny called to Jody,
"Remember where we'd seed the whoopin' cranes dancing so purty?"
Jody wouldn't have recognized the prairie. It was a flat body of water where even a crane might hesitate to wade and wander. Farther south was scrub again, then gallberry flats and bay heads. But where marsh should be was a lake. They reined in the horses. It was as though they had camped overnight on some strange borderland and had now come into another country. Fish were leaping in the air from water that a week ago had been land. And here, after all the miles, were the bears. They were fishing with an abandon that made them unaware of or indifferent to the approach of horses and riders. Two or three dozen black forms moved through the waters, belly deep. Fish jumped ahead of them. Penny called, "It's mullet." But mullet, Jody thought, lived in the ocean. They lived in Lake George with its touch of salt, its faint surge of tide. They lived in the tidal rivers and in a few freshwater rivers where flowing springs and swift currents pleased them as well as the ocean, and from which they might leap, as they were doing now, in tensile silver arcs. Penny said,
"It's plain as day. Lake George backed up Juniper Creek, and the creek backed up, and the spring overflowed onto the prairie. And here's mullet."
Buck said,
"We got a new prairie then, mullet prairie, and look at them bears."
Millwheel said,
"It's bear heaven. Well, men, how many do we want?"
He sighted his rifle experimentally. Jody blinked his eyes. He had never seen so many bears at once in his life, except in dreams. Penny said,
"Don't let's be hogs about it, even if 'tis bears."
Buck said,
"Four do us for a while."
"One'll do the Baxters. Jody, you want to kill a bear?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, now, man, if it's agreeable, we'll pick our shots here and spread out a little. Somebody'll be obliged to get a second shot, maybe three do Jody miss."
He assigned Jody the closest shot. It was a large fellow, probably a male. Penny said,
"Now, Jody, you ride to the left of mine till you get a bead on his cheek. When I give the word, everybody'll fire. If he's moved by that time, take the best head shot you can get. And if his head's down and hid from you, aim for his middle, and one of us'll finish him after."
Buck and Millwheel indicated their choices, and the group spread cautiously in both directions. Penny lifted his hand. They halted. Jody was trembling so violently that when he lifted his gun, he could see nothing in front of him but a blur of water. He forced himself to steady his aim. His bear was quartering from him, but he was able to draw a bead on the left cheek from the rear. Penny dropped his hand. Guns barked. There was a second bombardment from Buck and Millwheel. The horses reared a little. Jody couldn't remember having pulled the trigger. But 50 yards in front of him, a black body that had been upright lay half sunk in the water. Penny shouted,
"Nice shooting, boy,"
and rode forward. The remaining bears were scrambling across the swamp like paddle boats, churning the water behind them. It would take a long shot now to bring one down. Again, Jody was amazed at the speed of the bulky bodies. The first shot of each man had been accurate and deadly. Buck and Millwheel had only wounded on their second shots. The dogs, kept at heel, broke into bedlam. They barked in a frenzy and dashed into the water. It was too deep for wading and too thick with growth for swimming. They were forced to retreat, shrill with frustration. The men rode in close on the two wounded animals. They fired again, and the game lay still. The unharmed bears were vanishing before their eyes. No game was quicker or cleverer. Buck said,
"Now, we never figured on getting these scapers out in the water."
Jody had eyes only for his own kill. He couldn't believe that he had done it. Here lay food for the Baxter table for a fortnight, and it was of his providing. Millwheel said,
"We best go home and get a yoke of oxen."
Penny said, "Tell you, you got 5 to haul, and we ain't got but the 1. Now, I'm satisfied with the hunt, and I'm satisfied we all know for a while where to look for the game. Do it suit you? You help me and Jody with this one of his, and leave me keep this horse a day or two, and we'll just go on our way, and you go yours."
"Suits us,"
Penny said.
You'd think men our age would have thought to have throwed in a rope.
Who'd have guessed the whole blasted scrub was underwater?
Buck called.
Our legs is longer than you Baxter's. You stay in the saddle.
Penny was already on his feet. The water was over his knees. Jody was ashamed to stay on his horse as though he were a child. He too slid off into the water. The bottom was firm. He helped drag his bear to high ground. The foresters seemed unaware that it was important that he had shot it, for it was his first. Penny touched his shoulder, and that was praise enough. The bear would weigh better than 300 pounds. They agreed that it was best to have it lengthwise so that the portions might easily be thrown over the rumps of the two horses. They skinned it and were surprised at its fatness when deer and panther were so lean. The bears must have fed here through the latter days of the storm. Old Caesar jumped and shied when the half of the long frame was thrown across him. The taint of the hide was not to his liking. He had smelled the rank odor too often through alarmed nights at the clearing. Once a bear had climbed into the lot and was in the stall with him before Penny, awakened by his whinnying, had come to him. The forester horse was better able to carry the extra load in any case, and the bear hide was added to Penny's portion. Buck and Millwheel turned their horses' heads toward home. Penny called,
"Turn your hames backward, and the oxen can haul all the load to once it. Come see us." "You come."
They lifted their hands and were gone. Penny and Jody jogged after them. They would all use the same trail for some miles, but the foresters, unburdened on their fast horses, were already far ahead. To the east, they came out on the trail toward home. The going was slow and troublesome. Old Caesar would not follow behind the bear hide, but when Penny had Jody ride ahead, the forester horse insisted on taking the lead. There was a constant struggle. At last, through Juniper Prairie, Penny touched his heels to the horse and took a long lead. With the bear hide out of sight and smelling, old Caesar was content to trot along reasonably. At first, Jody was uneasy, alone in the new wilderness of water. Then, with his bear meat behind him, he felt bold again and mature. He had thought that he wanted to hunt forever. But when the tall trees of Baxter's Island drew in sight and he passed the path to the sinkhole and came to the split-rail fences of his father's fields, he was glad to be coming home. The fields were desolate from the waste of waters. The yard was swept barren. But he was coming in with meat that he had killed for the family. And Flag was waiting.
Chapter 21. For 2 weeks, Penny concerned himself with the salvaging of crops. The sweet potatoes weren't ready by 2 months for digging, but they were rotting and would be a total loss if they were not dug. Jody worked long hours at them. He must be careful to go deeply enough with the potato fork and not go too close to the middle of the beds. Then, by lifting carefully, he brought up a forkful of potatoes unharmed. When they were all dug, Ma Baxter spread them out to dry and cure as best as they could on the back porch. They all had to be gone over and more than half discarded. Rotting ends were cut off and with the nubbins set aside for the hogs. The sugar cane was flattened to the ground. There was nothing to do for the present but leave it, for it was immature. It was already putting out roots along the stalks, but it could be trimmed and salvaged later. The cowpea hay was ruined. It had been near maturity, and the week's soaking left it on the ground a moldy mass. The peas that the Baxters had shelled were the only salvage. 3 weeks after the flood, after good days of sun, Penny took his scythe to Mullet Prairie, as he now called it, and cut marsh grass and left it to cure.
"Good fodder and bad times," he said.
The prairie waters had receded and left no trace of the fish, except their stench. Even Jody, whom few odors offended, was sickened. The smell of death lay everywhere. Penny said uneasily,
"Something's wrong. That stink's due to be done with. Things is yet dying."
A month after the flood, in October, he returned with Jody in the wagon beside him to Mullet Prairie
to gather the cut and cured hay. Rip and Julia trotted along behind the wagon. Penny allowed Flag, too, to follow, for he had begun to make a great commotion whenever he was shut up and left behind in the shed. He ran sometimes ahead of old Caesar, sometimes when the road was wide enough beside him. Now and then he dropped back and frolicked with the dogs. He had learned to eat green stuff, and he stopped occasionally to nibble a tender bud or sprout. Jody said, "Look at him, Pa, pulling buds like he was growed." Penny smiled and said, "I tell you, never were such fawn." Suddenly old Julia gave tongue and tore to the right into the bushes. Rip followed, and Penny halted the wagon. "Go see what them fools is after, Jody." Jody jumped down and went after them. A few yards beyond, he was able to identify the trail. He called back, "Nothing but cat." Penny lifted his horn to blow the dogs in when he heard Julia bay. He dismounted and pushed into the thick growth. The dogs had the cat at bay, but there was no fight. Jody stood puzzled. The wildcat lay on its side, untouched. Julia and Rip circled, nipping, but with no responding attack. The cat bared its teeth and lashed its tail, but didn't stir. It was gaunt and weak. Penny said, "The creature's dying." "Leave it be." He called off the dogs and returned to the wagon. Jody asked, "What's it dying of, Pa?"
"Why, the creature's dies the same as us. Them as ain't killed by their enemies. He's likely old and couldn't catch himself nothing to feed on."
"His teeth wasn't worn down like a old creature."
Penny looked at him.
"Boy, you getting real observant. Now I like to see that."
There was still no explanation of the wildcat's feebleness. They reached the prairie and loaded the wagon with hay. Penny estimated that 3 more trips would be necessary. The marsh hay was coarse and stringy, but when frost had come and the wire grass was dry and harsh, Caesar and Trixie and the heifer calf would be glad to have it. They drove toward home leisurely. Old Caesar quickened his gait, and even Julia ran on ahead, eager, as all domestic animals, for home. Past the trail to the sinkhole, at the corner of the first fence row, Julia lifted her nose and bayed. Penny said,
"Now there'd be nothing there in broad daylight."
Julia was insistent, and jumped the fence and stopped. Her bay turned to a shrill barking. Rip, clumsy in bulldog fashion, clambered over the fence that the hound had cleared lightly. He too barked fiercely. Penny said,
"Well, I know better than to question the good dog's sense."
He stopped the wagon and took up his gun and went with Jody over the fence to the dogs. A buck deer lay in the corner. It shook its head, making a menacing motion with its horns. Penny lifted his gun, then lowered it.
"Now that buck's sick, too."
He approached close, and the deer didn't move. Its tongue lolled. Julie and Rip were in a frenzy. They couldn't understand the refusal of live game either to run or to fight.
"No use to waste shot."
He took his knife from its scabbard and went to the deer and slit its throat. It died with the quiet of a thing to whom death is only one short step beyond a present misery. He drove off the dogs and examined it carefully. Its tongue was black and swollen. Its eyes were red and watery. It was as thin as the dying wildcat. He said,
"This is worse than I figured. A plague has hit the wild creatures. It's the black tongue."
Jody had heard of human plagues. The wild animals had always seemed to him to be charmed and beyond all human ills. A creature died in the chase, or when another creature more powerful pounced and destroyed. Death in the scrub was clean and violent. Never a slow sickness and lingering. He stared down at the dead deer. He said,
"We'll not eat it, will we?"
Penny shook his head.
"'Tain't fitting."
The dogs were sniffing farther down the fence row. Julia barked again. Penny looked after her. A pile of carcasses lay in a heap. 2 old bucks and a yearling had died together. Jody had seldom seen his father's face so grave. Penny examined the plague-killed deer and turned away without speaking. Death seemed to have appeared wholesale out of the air.
"What done it, Pa? What killed him?"
Again, Penny shook his head.
I've never known what give the black tongue. Maybe it's the flood water full of dead things has got poisonous. A fear shot through Jody like a hot knife.
Pa, Flag, he'll not get it, will he?
Son, I've told you all I know.
They returned to the wagon and drove on and into the lot and unloaded the hay. Jody felt weak and sick. Flag bleated. He went to him and clutched him around the neck and held him tightly until the fawn pulled away for breath. Jody whispered,
"Don't get it. Please don't get it."
At the house, Ma Baxter received the news stolidly. She had shed her tears and wailed her laments when the crops were ruined. As the going of too many of her children had wrung her dry of feeling, now the passing of the game was only another unprotested incident. She said only,
"Best water the stock from the high trough and not let him get to the seepage pool."
Jody felt a hope for Flag. He would feed him only what he ate himself, keep him away from the tainted grass, water him from the Baxters' own drinking water. If Flag died, he thought with a mournful satisfaction, they would die together. He asked,
"Do folkses get the black tongue?"
"Only the creeters."
He tied Flag stoutly in the shed when he made the next trip in the wagon for hay. Penny tied up the dogs as well. Jody asked countless questions. Would the hay be tainted? Would the plague last forever? Would there be any game left?
To all, Penny, who knew he had thought almost everything, shook his head in ignorance.
"Keep still, boy, for the Lord's sake. The things happened as never happened before. How would every man know the answers?"
His father left him alone to rake hay and load the wagon while he unhitched Caesar and rode on to the foresters for information. Jody felt uneasy and miserable, alone at the edge of the marsh. The world seemed empty. Only over the scrub the buzzards wheeled, profiting. He hurried at his work and had finished it long before his father returned. He climbed to the top of the load of hay and lay flat on his back, staring at the sky. He decided that the world was a very peculiar place to live in. Things happened that had no reason and made no sense and did harm, like the bears and panthers, but without their excuse of hunger. He didn't approve. Against the uncomfortable and alarming things that happened, he balanced Flag. His father, too, of course, but Flag lived in a secret place in his heart that had been long aching and vacant. If Flag were not stricken with the plague, the flood, he decided, would be interesting. If he lived to be as old as Penny, as old as Grandma Hutto and Ma Forrester, he would never forget, he knew, the fright and enchantment of the endless days and nights of storm. He wondered if the quail would die of the black tongue. In another month, his father had told him, he might make a trap of crossed twigs and catch a few for eating. Shot was too valuable to be wasted on such small mouthfuls. But Penny would not allow them to be trapped until the covey was full grown, and he insisted each year that two or three pairs of cocks and hens be left for seed. And would the turkeys die, and the squirrels, and the wolves, and bears, and panthers? Speculation absorbed him. When a muffled sound in the distance became the recognizable beat of old Caesar's hooves, he had forgotten his discomfort. Penny was as grave as before, but he was relieved and stimulated by his talk with the foresters. On the trail of game for food, they had discovered the condition 2 days before. No breed of animals, they said, had been spared. They'd found the predatory creatures dead or dying beside their quarry, on an equal footing at last, the weak and the strong brought together to earth, the sharp-toothed and the dull, the clawless and the clawed. Jody asked,
"Will everything die?"
Penny spoke sharply.
"I've told you the last time, don't ask me them questions. Wait, like me, and see."
Chapter 22. By November, the Baxters and the Foresters knew the extent of the plague and what to expect, both of the game and the predatory animals during the winter. The deer had been cut down to a fraction of their usual numbers. Where a herd of a dozen had fed across the edge of the clearing, a lone buck or doe leaped the fence into the cowpea field in search of food that was not there. The deer became bold, nosing in the old sweet potato beds for undiscovered nubbins. The quail appeared in almost their usual numbers, but the wild turkeys were decimated. From that fact, Penny concluded that the damage indeed lay somehow in the polluted swamp waters, for the turkeys fed there and the quail didn't. All the food animals, deer and turkey, squirrel and possum, were so scarce that a day's hunt might produce nothing. The unfriendly animals had suffered as heavy losses. At first, Penny thought that this would be of advantage. It became plain almost at once that the result was to make the remaining killers hungrier and more desperate because of their own shortened food supply. He became alarmed for the Baxter hogs and built a pen for them inside the lot. All the family went together to the woods and gathered acorns and scrub palmetto berries for the hogs. Penny set aside a measure of the new corn for fattening them. A few days later, a stamping and squealing sounded in the lot at midnight. The dogs, aroused, ran barking, and Penny and Jody pulled on their breeches and followed with a torch. The fattest barrow was missing. The kill had been made so neatly that there was no sign of struggle. A small trail of blood led across the lot and over the fence. It had required a large animal to kill and carry a heavy hog so handily. Penny took a hasty look at the tracks. "There," he said, "a big un." Old Julia begged to take the trail, and Penny himself was tempted, for the killer might be easily and quickly come up on, gorging. But the night was dark, and the risk of an encounter if the bear should be shot and only wounded was, he decided, too great. The trail would still be fresh enough in the morning. They went back to bed, to sleep lightly. At daylight, they called the dogs and set out. The track was that of old Slewfoot. Penny said, "That is good to have knowed. Him, of all the bears in the scrub, had lived through a plague." Slewfoot had fed a short distance away. He had eaten heartily and scratched a covering of trash across the carcass. Then he had gone south and crossed Juniper Creek. Penny said, "He'll be back again to feed. A bear'll stay a week with his kill. I've seed 'em fight off the buzzards even when they didn't want to eat theirselves. It was airy bear but this un. We would set us a trap, but no trap was made. We'll fool him since he lost his toe in one."
"Can't we come wait for him and catch him at his feeding?"
"We'll try."
"Tomorrow?"
"Tomorrow." They turned back toward home. A light galloping sound came close and closer. Flag had broken loose and joined the hunt. He kicked up his heels and held his small tail erect.
"Ain't he a sight, Pa?"
"He's a sight, son, all right." The next day, Penny was down with chills and fever. He was in bed for 3 days. There was no use in trying to catch old Slewfoot now. Jody begged to go alone and watch for him in ambush, but Penny refused permission. The great bear was too wise and too dangerous, he said, and Jody was too rattle-headed. Ma Baxter said,
"Now I don't crave to feed them shoats to no bear, even if they ain't plumb fat."
When Penny was able to leave the bed, they agreed that it was best to kill the hogs without waiting either for the full moon or for the animals to be properly fattened. Jody split fat wood and built a fire under the syrup kettle and brought water from the sinkhole to heat in it. He tilted a barrel on one side and propped it with sand. When the water was exactly right, Ma Baxter ladled it into the barrel. Penny killed the hogs and scalded them one after the other in the barrel, twirling them by the legs with his quick deftness. Ma and Jody had to help him lift them to the cross trees, for his strength suddenly failed him. All three worked furiously at the scraping, for the hair must come off before it set. Again, Jody marveled at the metamorphosis of live creatures in whom he had felt interest and sympathy into cold flesh that made acceptable food. He was glad when the killing was over. Now, scraping away on the smooth, firm hides, he enjoyed seeing the skin become clean and white. He began to anticipate the smell of sausage frying and of cracklings browning in the fat. Nothing was wasted, not even the entrails. The meat itself was dressed out into hams and shoulders, side meat and belly bacon, which would be cured with salt and pepper and brown sugar made from their own cane juice, and then smoked slowly over hickory coals in a smokehouse. There remained the hocks and feet, which would be pickled in brine. the ribs and backbones, which would be fried and put down in crocks under a protective layer of lard, the heads and livers and kidneys and hearts, which would be made into head cheese and put down the same way. The trimmings of lean meat would be ground into sausage. The fat would be tried out in the wash pot, and the lard put down in crocks and cans, and the brown cracklings laid away for shortening in cornbread. The stomachs and intestines would be scraped and turned and soaked and then used for casings in which the sausage meat would be stuffed, and the sausages hung in festoons and smoked along with the hams and bacons. Odds and ends would be cooked with cornmeal for the dogs and chickens. Even the tails were dressed. Only one part, like a windpipe, seemed without use and was tossed away. Jody asked,
"What's that, Ma?"
"Well, that's his goozle."
"What's a goozle?"
"Well, if he didn't have no goozle, he couldn't squeal."
8 hogs in all were dressed. Only the old boar hog, 2 young sows, and the brood sow, peace offering from the foresters, were left to begin the cycle over again. These must take their chances in the woods. They would be fed the slops and a little corn at evening to tow them into their pen to be shut up at night for approximate safety. For the rest, they must root for a living, maintaining life if they could, dying if they must. Supper that night was a feast, and the table seemed lavish long afterward. There would soon be collards in the garden behind the house and wild mustard greens all about the clearing. There would be bacon to cook with them, and with the dried shelled cow peas. Cracklings would hold out for crackling bread for months. The Baxters were in fair shape for the winter. The season was the most abundant of the year. The scarceness of game wouldn't be so serious with the smokehouse full. The flattened sugar cane had sent out whiskered roots along the stalks and had to be torn free of the clutching earth. The stalks were like ragged mops. The extraneous roots had to be cut off before the cane could be ground. Jody drove old Caesar around and around the small cane mill, and Penny fed the thin fiber stalks into the revolving gears. The yield was low, and the syrup was thin and acid. But there was again sweetening in the house. Ma Baxter dropped oranges into the last boiling of syrup, and the result made a rich preserve. The corn wasn't much damaged, even the ears that had stood in the field through the rains. Jody spent hours every day at the millstone. The lower stone had small grooves that waved out from the center, like the spirals on a snail shell. The upper stone rested on it, and the pair sat in a wooden frame with 4 legs. The shelled corn was fed into a hole in the center of the upper millstone, and when the ground meal reached a certain fineness, it sifted out through the waste hole and was collected in a bucket. Swinging the overhead lever in a circle hour after hour was monotonous, but not unpleasant. Jody dragged up a high stump and, when his back was tired, sat on it by way of rest and variety. He said to his father,
"I do most of my figuring here."
Penny said,
"I hope you do a heap of it, for the flood's done you out in a teacher. The foresters and me had it settled to board a teacher between us for you and Fodder Wing this winter. When Fodder Wing died, I still figured I'd do some trapping and get cash money that-a-way. But the creeters are so scarce it now, and the hide's so poor, it's no use."
Jody said comfortingly, "That's all right. I know a heap now."
"Well, that just proves your ignorance, young feller. I do hate for you to grow up and not know nothing. You'll just have to make out this year with what little I can learn you."
The prospect was more than acceptable. Penny would start him on his reading lesson or his sums, and then before either of them knew it, would be off on a tail. Jody went on with his grinding with a light heart. Flag came up, and he stopped to let the fawn lick the meal at the waste hole. He often took a taste himself. The stones became hot from the friction, and the meal smelled like popcorn or corn pone. When he was hungry enough, a mouthful was palatable, but it never tasted as good as it smelled. Flag was bored with the inactivity and wandered away. He was becoming bolder and was sometimes gone in the scrub for an hour or so. There was no holding him in the shed. He had learned to kick down the loose board walls. Ma Baxter expressed the belief only because it was her hope that the fawn was going wild and would eventually disappear. Jody was no longer even troubled by the remark. He knew that the same restlessness came to the fawn that came to him. Flag merely felt the need of stretching his legs and exploring the world about him. They understood each other perfectly. He knew, too, that when Flag wandered away, he moved in a circle and was never out of hearing of Jody's call. That evening, Flag got himself in serious disgrace. The sweet potatoes had been cured and heaped in a pile on the back porch. Flag roamed there while everyone was occupied and found that by butting the pile, the potatoes would roll. The sound and motion charmed him. He butted the pile until it was strewn over most of the yard. He tramped on the potatoes with his sharp hooves. The odor enticed him, and he nibbled one. The taste pleased him, and he went from one to another, nibbling. Ma Baxter discovered him too late. Grave damage had been done. She drove him furiously with a palmetto broom. The game was much the one of chase that Jody played with him. When she turned away, he turned as well, and, following, butted her in her ample rear. Jody came in from his grinding to a hullabaloo and a crisis. Even Penny upheld Ma Baxter in the gravity of the matter. Jody couldn't endure the expression on his father's face. He couldn't keep back his tears. He said, "He didn't know what he was doing." "I know, Jody, but the harm's as bad to the taters as if he'd done it for meanness. We got scarcely enough rations now to do the year."
"Then I'll eat no taters and make it up."
"Nobody wants you should do without taters. You just got to keep track of that scaper. If you keep him, it's your place to see he don't do no damage."
"I couldn't watch him and grind corn all too."
"Then keep him tied good in the shed when you can't watch him."
"He hates that old dark shed."
"Then pen him."
Jody rose before day the next morning and began work on a pen in the corner of the yard. He studied its position with an eye to using the fence for two corners of the pen and to having it where he could see Flag from most of his own work spots, the millstone, the woodpile, and the barn lot in particular. Flag would be content, he knew, if he was in sight of him. He finished the pen in the evening when his chores were done. The next day he untied Flag from the shed and lifted him into the pen, kicking and struggling. Flag was over the bars and out and at his heels again before he reached the house. Penny found him again in tears.
"Don't get in a swivet, boy. We'll work this out one way or t'other. Now the taters is near about the only thing he'll bother. You keep him out in the house. They ought to be under kiver anyway. Now you take down that tipply-tumbly pen and build a coop to kiver the taters, like a chicken coop with two sides coming to a peak. I'll start you on it."
Jody wiped his nose on his sleeve.
"I sure am obliged, Pa."
With the potatoes bedded and covered, there was no more serious trouble. Flag had to be kept out of the smokehouse as well as the house, for he had grown so large that by rearing on his hind legs he could reach the hanging sides of bacon and lick the salt. Ma Baxter said,
"I don't want nobody but me licking the meat I eat, let alone a nasty creeter."
Flag was annoyingly curious as well, and buttered over a can of lard in the smokehouse to hear the cover fall and see what was inside. The day was cool, and the thin, loose lard was discovered before it had run out. But such intrusions could be taken care of simply by keeping the doors shut, as was desirable in any case. Jody developed a good memory for such details. Penny said,
"It'll do you no harm to learn to be careful. You got to learn taking care of rations comes first of all. First, after getting them."
Chapter 23. The first heavy frost came at the end of November. The leaves of the big hickory at the north end of the clearing turned as yellow as butter. The sweet gums were yellow and red, and the blackjack thicket across the road from the house flamed with a red as bright as a campfire. The grapevines were golden, and the sumac was like oak embers. The October blooming of dog fennel and sea myrtle had turned to a feathery fluff. The days came in cool and crisp, warm to a pleasant slowness, and chilled again. The Baxters sat in the evening in the front room before the first hearth fire. Ma Baxter said,
"Don't seem possible fire time's here again."
Jody lay flat on his belly, staring into the flames. It was here that he was often able to see Fodderwing's Spaniard. By squinting his eyes and waiting for the blaze to shift just so up a crotched log, he could picture, with no trouble at all, a horseman in a red cape, wearing a shining helmet. The picture never lasted long, for the wood stirred and the logs fell, and the Spaniard rode away again. He asked,
"Did the Spaniards have red capes?"
Penny said, "I don't know, son. Now you see how handy a teacher'd be." Ma Baxter said wonderingly,
"Now, what put such an idea as that in your head?"
He rolled over on his side and stretched one arm across Flag. The fawn lay asleep, his legs tucked under his stomach like a calf. His white tail twitched in his sleep. Ma Baxter didn't mind his being in the house in the evening after supper. She even turned an unseeing eye on his sleeping in Jody's bedroom, for at least then he was into no mischief. She took him for granted with a critical disinterest she showed the dogs. They were outside sleeping under the house. On bitter nights, Penny brought them in, too, not that it was necessary, but because he enjoyed sharing his comfort. Ma Baxter said,
"Throw a stick on the fire. I can't quite see to foller my seams."
She had cut down a pair of Penny's winter breeches for Jody. She said,
"Now you take another notion to grow like you done this spring, and I'll be cutting down your breeches to fit your daddy."
Jody laughed out loud, and Penny pretended to be offended. Then his eyes twinkled in the firelight, and his thin shoulders shook. Ma Baxter rocked complacently. They were all pleased whenever she made a joke. Her good nature made the same difference in the house as the hearth fire had made in the chill of the evening. Penny said,
"You and me, it ought to be getting out that speller, boy."
"Maybe the roaches has ate it."
Ma Baxter poised her needle in the air. She pointed it at him.
"You best study your grammar, too," she said. "You ought to say, 'The roaches has eat it.'"
She rocked again, placidly. Penny said,
"You know, I got a idee we'll not have no great cold this winter."
Jody said,
"I like it cold, if 'twasn't for toting in wood."
"Yes, sir. It looked like a good winter. We come out a heap better than I figured on the crops and meat. Maybe a feller can get his breath now."
Ma Baxter said,
"About time."
"Yes, sir. Old Starvation's doing his hunting another place."
The evening wore on without further speech. There was no sound but the hearth fire simmering, the puff of Penny's pipe, and the creak-pat, creak-pat of Ma Baxter's rocker on the board floor. Once a great whistling passed over the house, like a sudden wind in the pine trees. Ducks were flying south. Jody looked up at his father. Penny pointed the stem of his pipe upward and nodded. If he were not so comfortable, Jody would have liked to ask what kind they were and where they were going. If he could know such things as his father knew them, he could manage, he thought, without the sums and the spelling. He liked the reading. Most of it was tales, not as good as Penny's, none was, but still tales. Penny said,
"Well, it's go to sleep here, or find the bed."
He rose and knocked out his pipe on the hearth. As he bent, the dogs began to bark and dashed from under the house. It seemed as though his stirring had awakened them from sleep, and they had plunged after an imaginary enemy. Penny opened the front door and cupped his hand to his ear.
"Now, I don't hear a thing but them dogs."
The calf bleated. The cry was at once of terror and pain. There was another that lifted to a scream, then was abruptly muffled. Penny ran to the kitchen for his gun.
"Fetch a light."
Jody chose to believe that his mother was indicated. He ran after his father with his own gun, which since old Slewfoot's last visit he was allowed to keep loaded. Ma Baxter followed unwillingly with a lighted splinter, feeling her way with slow feet. Jody climbed the lot fence. He was sorry now that he had not brought the torch himself. He could see nothing. He could hear only a tumult of fighting and snarling, a snapping of many teeth, the voices of Rip and old Julia silenced. Above it came the desperate voice of his father.
Get 'em, Julia. Hold 'em, Rip. My Lord, the light!
Jody turned back over the fence and ran to his mother and took the torch from her. The thing that was happening was for Penny to handle. He ran back again. He lifted the torch high in his hand. The wolves had invaded the lot and killed the heifer calf. A band of them, 3 dozen or more, milled about the enclosure. Their eyes caught the light in pairs like corrupt pools of shining water. They were emaciated and rough-coated. Their fangs glistened as white as garfish bones. He heard his mother screaming beyond the fence and became aware that he was screaming too. Penny shouted, "Hold that light still!" He tried to steady it. He saw Penny lift his gun and shoot once, then again. The wolves turned and flowed over the fence in a gray wave. Rip snapped at their heels. Penny ran shouting after them. Jody ran behind him, trying to keep the light on the swift forms. He remembered that he had his own gun in the other hand. He pushed it to his father, and Penny took it and shot again. The wolves were gone like a thunderstorm. Rip hesitated, his light hide plain in the darkness, then turned and limped back to his master. Penny stooped and petted him. He too turned and walked back slowly into the lot. The cow was bellowing. Penny said quietly, "I'll take the light."
He lifted it and swung it about the enclosure. The shredded body of the calf lay in the middle. Near it lay old Julia, her teeth in the throat of a gaunt wolf. The wolf was taking its last breaths, its eyes glazed. It was tick-ridden and mangy. Penny said, "All right, gal, leave go." Julia released her hold and stood back. Her teeth, worn by age to the flatness of corn kernels, had accounted for the only casualty. Penny looked at the mangled calf and at the dead wolf. Then, as though he stared into the green eyes of an invisible enemy, he looked off into the night. He seemed small and shrunken. He said, "Well." He handed Jody his gun and retrieved his own from the side of the fence. He leaned and picked up a hoof of the calf and walked decisively toward the house, dragging the carcass. Jody understood, shivering, that his father meant to have it handy if the marauders returned. He was still frightened. A panther or a bear at bay always terrified him. But there the men had always stood with leveled guns. There the dogs had room to dart in and get away. The fierce pack in the lot had made a sight he wanted never to see again. He wished his father had dragged the carcass into the woods. Ma Baxter came to the door and called quaveringly,
"I had to come to the house in the dark. I never been so scared. Were it bears again?"
They went into the house, and Penny brushed past her to go to the hearth to the swinging kettle for hot water for the dog's wounds. "Wolves."
"Oh, dear heaven. Did they kill the calf?"
"They killed it."
"Oh, dear heaven. And hit a heifer."
She followed him about while he poured hot water in a basin and bathed the dog's wounds. They weren't serious.
"I wished I could get the dogs on them beasts one at a time," he said grimly.
In the warm safety of the house, bold now because his mother was afraid, Jody could speak at last.
"Will they be back tonight, Pa? Will we go hunt 'em?"
Penny rubbed boiled pine gum into Rip's one deep wound, a jagged tear on one flank. He was in no mood for answers or talk of any kind. He didn't speak until he was done with the dogs and had made them a good bed under the house near his bedroom window. He didn't mean to be taken by surprise again. He came in and washed his hands and warmed them by the fire.
"Now this be the kind of time a man needs a snort," he said. "I sure aim to beg a court off from the foresters tomorrow."
"You going there tomorrow?"
"I got to have help. My dogs is all right, but a big woman and a little man and a yearling boy is no match for that many hungry wolves hunting in a pack."
It gave Jody a strange feeling to have his father admit that he could not handle anything alone. But the wolves had never before descended on the clearing in a band. Deer and small animals had been plentiful to feed them. Only a few had come, singly or in pairs, skulking about timorously, running at the first alarm. They had never before been a major menace.
Penny took off his breeches and turned his back to the fire.
"Now, I was scared," he said. "My very bottom's cold."
The Baxters went to bed. Jody made sure his window was tight shut.